Welcome to episode number 51 of the Video Game History Hour, presented by the Video Game History Foundation. Every episode, we'll be bringing in an expert guest, someone who's done their research or lived through it and has an interesting story from video game history to tell. My name is Kelsey Liu, and I'm the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm here, as always, with Frank Cifaldi, the founder and co-director of the Video Game History Foundation.
And our guest today, once again, is Norman Caruso, a.k.a. the Gaming Historian. Norm's latest...
Oh, I'm sorry. Did
you? What'd you say?
You said the.
I was going to say the gaming
historian. The gaming historian. It's an important distinction.
I capitalized the. I've rebranded you, Norm. I'm sorry.
Oh, good. Thank you.
You are the only one now. You got that SEO down, buddy. Norm's latest documentary is the most in-depth investigation that will ever exist about the U-Force. A video game controller from, 1990? Does that sound right?
Correct.
That was very forward-thinking, maybe still a little too forward-thinking based on Microsoft's lack of success with something similar. Norm, welcome back once again to the Video Game History Hour.
Thank you very much. Excited to be here to talk about the U-Force. I'm sure you all are very excited to talk about the U-Force, everyone's favorite controller.
I'll be honest, I was like, okay, gonna watch something about the U-Force. This I like dumb things, so I'm like, this will be fun for me because I like dumb things. But by the end of it, I was like, no, this is an interesting story. This is a genuinely interesting story.
Good.
So good job.
Thank you. My work here is done.
Okay, what are we talking about? What the heck is the U-Force?
The U-Force is a controller from 1990 for the Nintendo Entertainment System. It looks like a laptop. And it basically lets you control a game without touching anything. It uses infrared emitters and detectors to detect where your hand is within this force field of a laptop. And that's how you can play your games.
Theoretically. So yes. This really was a radical idea, though. I mean, we're talking 1990, folks. I mean, this is for the Nintendo Entertainment System, which I don't think we specified here. And video game controllers at home up to that point were, you know, all about just touching buttons, touching joysticks, like actually like physically controlling a mechanism. This was an idea very much like the Kinect in modern parlance, where the idea was that a device would read your hand positions without you actually touching anything and affect the gameplay on the screen.
Yes. And it was, as you said, during those days, the way to play the game was to press a button. And that's probably why the U-Force didn't do very well, because it's just easier to press a button than move your hand around to try to press a button, right?
Spoilers, it didn't do well.
Well, in 1989, I thought it was so interesting, and you mentioned this in your video. I mean, you're dealing with a bit of a chip shortage at that time period, and you know, Nintendo's still doing their you can only release a handful of games per publisher per year, and so but video games are blowing up, so people want other ways to make money on the video game industry, which is this growing thing. So in 89, there was a lot of really weird controllers. Like, that was specifically a very strange year for things like the Rock and Roller and the Power Glove, which we'll get into. But it struck me that these, like, all sort of happened generally around the same time. Which...
Well, I think there were, like, two gaming chairs even around this time, which, Norm, I think you've even done a video
Yeah, on. The hot seat.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, 89 was, when I was doing the research, I was shocked by how many Nintendo controllers debuted at the 1989 Winter Consumer Electronics Show. It was basically every weird, obscure Nintendo controller made its debut at that show. And it's because, like you mentioned, companies had a 5-game-per-year limit, and Nintendo was making tons of money, and they wanted these licensees wanted to make more money. So they said, hey, let's make controllers because there's no limit on those. So yeah, you had the Roland Rocker from LJN. You had the Power Glove from Mattel. You had Bishu made a bunch of controllers. Comerica put out a bunch of wireless controllers. Acclaim made controllers. And then, of course, you have Bruderbund's U-Force.
So tell us about the inventor of the U-Force, Dave Capper, because I think, you know, this doesn't exist without there being a sort of tinkerer to come up with this weird concept.
Yeah, so Dave Capper was, he was really a marketing guy. That's kind of how he rose to the ranks. He got a job at Mattel in the beginning, and he worked on the He-Man toy line. I don't know if you remember a He-Man toy where, I honestly can't remember the name of it, but it was like a throne, and you open this skull above the throne, a bunch of slime falls on whoever's sitting in the throne. So he came up with that toy.
I'm sure parents loved that one.
Yeah. People love
anything people love messy. Slime.
Yeah. Kids love slime. Actually, I have a friend, he goes by Pixel Dan. He does toy reviews on YouTube, and he said people just love slime videos. Kids love slime. I don't know. But
so
anyway,
are you going to make your great pivot into slime history?
I might do history of slime.
Okay. Well, what I'm going to pivot into opening Kinder eggs to reveal the toy, but every time it's slime.
Oh, man. Okay.
I've never heard anyone pronounce it that way at first. So I had no idea what you
Kinder?
Were talking about. Yeah.
Kinder? I don't know. Kinder. Yeah. Kinder. It's spelled Kinder. Whatever. They're Kinder eggs.
I'm saying I didn't know what you were talking about for a second.
Listen, those Cadbury eggs are very, very mean. These are Kinder eggs. They give you toys.
I should not have justified that with a laugh. That was terrible.
I grew up in Scotland, and that was my favorite candy was Kinder Surprise eggs. And then I moved back to the United States, and they were illegal here. So
yeah,
that was a real bummer.
Yeah, triple threat with those videos. But anyway,
yeah. Let me get back to Dave Capper.
Sure, I don't know.
It has nothing to do with Kinder Surprise eggs. He worked at Mattel, and then he got a job at Galoob, working on Micro Machines. The fast talking guy that did those mm-hmm. Micro Machines commercials. He came up with that concept, that marketing concept. So he was a really prolific marketing guy, and he was just always looking for, you know, new products, new toys to come up with. He helped with the Koosh ball. So he helped market that. And then he saw the popularity of the Nintendo Entertainment System. And he thought, I want to find a new way to interact and play with these video games. And that's when he came up with the idea for the U-Force. And it was really based on these old electronic kits he grew up playing with called Heath kits. I actually didn't even know this thing was a thing, but it was these kits you could order by mail and you could basically build electronics on your own. It came with everything you needed. And so he remembered as a kid, he had this kit where, you know, you could touch a disc and it would light up something. So like, think of like an elevator button when you press the button and the button lights up. So he started messing with that, and he messed with the sensitivity, and he said, okay, if I turn the sensitivity way up, I can get close to the disc, not touch it. And it affects the light. So my hand just has to be around the disc and then the light will turn on and off. And so he took that idea and he combined it with a theremin, which is this musical instrument where you don't touch it. You just place your hand above it and it affects the audio waves and it makes this weird noise. Kind of like, think of like a Martian movie or something. I think the Beach Boys used it one time.
Good Vibrations.
Good Vibrations, yeah.
During the chorus, you can hear it in the background. That's a theremin.
So he had this idea down. Theremin, sensitivity, don't touch anything, and to affect gameplay. But that was kind of like the limit of what he could do. He needed an engineer to kind of bring this idea into life. And so he found an engineer at the Museum of Play. Not the Museum of Play, that's in Rochester. The Exploratorium in San Francisco. And he found an engineer named Stan Axelrod, who was in charge of designing exhibits at the Exploratorium. And Stan Axelrod was the one who suggested, oh, we can use infrared, which was a pretty common technology in television sets.
Well, look, I do want to ask what infrared is, but
sure.
But before that, let's acknowledge that Stan Axelrod is like a perfect, I don't know, road rash character or something, like a like a video game racing.
It is a very good name.
Stan Axelrod? Yeah. Oh, his name. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great name.
Yeah. But yeah, okay. So it uses infrared technology. So I think my frame of reference for infrared would be on a television remote control. Maybe not anymore. I'm not sure what the tech is now, but on older TV remotes, when you press a button, there would be a little red flash on the front, and that's an infrared light that your TV has a signal to read the pulses from or something.
Right. So infrared is basically a light that we can't see with our own eyes. But I am not a technical person whatsoever. I had to like deep dive into this when I was making the video to make sure I understood what infrared was. But basically you can transmit data through this infrared. So you have an emitter, which would be on your remote control. You press a button saying, I want to turn the volume up. And then the light flashes to your television. Your television has a detector and it detects the data coming through and it says, oh, this person wants to turn the volume up. So it turns the volume up on the television. That's basically how it works.
So the way that it ends up working in, first of all, this giant T-shaped prototype that looks like it probably worked a lot better than the retail thing.
Yes.
The way the prototype and eventually the U-Force itself worked is that there were, how many, 8, 9 IR sensors, something like that?
Oh, it had 9, which shocked me.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, when you look at the U-Force, it looks like it has places for 10 pairs of emitters and detectors. There's only 9 though. If you open it up like a laptop on that bottom surface, the top right corner where you think would be an infrared emitter, there's nothing there. That top right corner does absolutely nothing. So there are 9 pairs of infrared emitters and detectors.
Do you know what the purpose of that was? Like, was that a cost saving measure? You just don't need, area? Guessing,
well, okay. So what I was going to explain was that essentially the IR beams, and you illustrate this so well in the video, everyone go watch it to understand, is that these lights are sort of intersecting and almost creating like a cube of sensors and detecting where your hand is based on where that is. And we should say that using IR, it can also detect, much like Norm was talking about with the diodes, basically how far your hand is from the sensor as well. So you have that full analog movement. And Kelsey, my guess is that they had enough sensors that they could essentially detect that same area over there without needing another one would be my guess. It was just a cost-saving measure because it's like, well, we can already detect when something is over there because it's like on this one, but not on this one is my guess.
Right. Yeah.
All right. I'll accept that explanation.
Thank you. Thank you. I made it up.
Yeah. So. No, it sounds about right to me. Something before we move on any further, I mean, you had the chance to interview Dave Capper, like pretty a lot. It seems like, I mean, he really colored the story here. And before he showed off what would eventually become the U-Force prototype, that big T-shaped thing,
right,
he had another one that you only showed briefly, but I thought did a really good job of illustrating with LEDs or some sort of lights, just how it was detecting the positioning of your hand. It was like a box, and he was just kind of waving his hand around it, and little red lights on there were lighting up in different places to determine his hand position. So I thought that was a really good kind of like in-between step into getting where you get to the U-Force.
Yeah, it's just kind of an evolution of this idea. So that was the first box that they came up with to test the infrared to see how it could work. And yeah, and then it evolved into that giant T-shape box that you see in the video as well, which according to Dave Capper worked really, really well, especially with a game like Punch Out, because you can like move your hands in it. But again, you look at that and you think that's cool, but like it's really big. And like, how do you sell that
as an arcade game?
There you go.
Like genuinely, that was my first thought with something that big. I'm like, that looks like it works pretty well. And this gimmick might work in like an arcade.
And it does. What is that rhythm game where you're holding your hands over?
Oh, yeah. Pair Paradise.
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah. Robin in the production booth is nodding. Yeah. Smiling. I think you nailed that.
Familiar. The other thing that I talked to John Mann, who was in charge. He was kind of a manager in production. And so I asked him, you know, he said, yeah, the prototypes worked really well. And so I said, well, how come, you know, when you get to the actual retail product, it's kind of wonky. It doesn't work like you would expect sometimes. And he said the biggest issue was in those prototypes, they were buying infrared emitters and detectors from, like, you know, Radio Shack, which were like $5 an infrared emitter and detector. They were pricey, but they worked really well. And then you go to manufacturing, you have to make these infrared emitters and detectors for like pennies each. So they're not very good infrared emitters and detectors. So
someone could probably make a U-Force today that's really good and really accurate.
I was going to say modify an existing one with good IR sensors.
You have to know how to tune them, but yeah.
Play nuclear rat attack or whatever. Yeah.
And I didn't mention this in the video, but the actual way the unit kind of processes these signals and positionings, it uses an Apple II CPU.
Interesting.
Okay. Yep. All right. So, you know, that excellent segue. Let's talk about Brüderbund. So Brüderbund was a well-known computer software maker at this time, most of their success on the Apple II. But how did they get into the console games industry?
So Brüderbund, as you mentioned, was one of the top publishers of computer software at the time. And what I learned from some of these interviews was the computer software industry was changing rapidly. It wasn't like, you know, back in the day, like one or two people could make a game and then sell it to like Brüderbund, and Brüderbund would pay royalties on it, right? They said it was becoming more and more Hollywood-like. So you would spend months working on this game with a whole team, and you would release it, and you would hope it would do really well. And so the industry was rapidly changing, and one of the things that was changing was licensing. So Brüderbund was taking their games that they published on computers, and they were licensing them out to different companies to publish on other platforms. And one of them was Lode Runner, which was one of their more popular games. A Japanese company called Hudson Soft liked Lode Runner and said, we want to put it on this brand new console that just came out over here in Japan. It's called the Famicom. We think it's going to do really well. And so Brüderbund licensed it to them. And Lode Runner was the first third-party game to sell 1 million copies on the Famicom.
So, well, and I think so. They Raid on Bungling Bay was also licensed by them, and I think it was also a million seller.
Yep. So Hudson Soft did Raid on Bungling Bay as well. And so Brüderbund was like, wow, that was really easy, and it made us a lot of money. So they got into licensing quite a bit at that time. And then, of course, Nintendo says, we're going to bring the Famicom to North America as the Nintendo Entertainment System. And they went to Brüderbund right away because they knew how popular Lode Runner was on the Famicom. And they said, hey, we're bringing this to North America. We want you to become a licensee. And at first, Brüderbund said no because they remembered the video game crash and they were kind of hesitant to get involved in that again because they were a computer software company.
Well, and the other thing too about NES games at that time, you know, Nintendo's controlling the supply, and you have to put down money as like an investment on manufacturing all of these cartridges. I mean, you have to trust that your product is going to sell a certain number of units and be like, okay, let's go ahead, let's manufacture 50,000 of these. That's a big risk when you are still thinking about the game crash.
Well, it's even riskier than that too, which and I think you know this already, but Nintendo often wouldn't even fulfill your orders all the way. Like, you might order 2 million units and get 500,000 manufactured with Nintendo going, yeah, it's all we could do. And it might be a big hit, and by the time that, you know, you manage to manufacture more, that it's not a hit anymore. And, you know, like, it's it was being a third party Nintendo publisher was very rough in the NES, even though everyone was making money. It was just like there was constant high stakes gambling dealing with Nintendo, who was not your friend. Essentially,
no. And that was something Dave Capper mentioned near the end of the video. He said, you know, with computer software, Brüderbund could just print it as they needed it. But with Nintendo, yeah, like Kelsey mentioned, you had to make this investment And then again, you don't know how many you're going to get from Nintendo. So it just became too big of a risk for Broderbund in the end. But we'll get back to 1986, where Nintendo was trying to court Broderbund into this. And again, Broderbund said no at first. But then they start to see the Nintendo Entertainment System take off. And they say, okay, well, you know, this is another revenue stream for us. It did well in Japan. Let's try it here in North America. And so in 1987, they become a Nintendo licensee at the Summer Consumer Electronics Show.
So let's think. So they were licensing games from IREM, like Deadly Towers. Yeah. They licensed through the same partnership. They licensed Napoleon Senki as well. That didn't end up shipping here. But they were also republishing their own games that they had licensed out, right? So they licensed out Load Runner to Hudson and then got the game back from them to publish here. Mm-hmm. There's some interesting stuff. Like there's early promotional material for them publishing Squoon, which they didn't publish ultimately. I think IREM did it themselves. Right. But so it's kind of a mixture of the Broderbund classics with stuff that we found in Japan at first.
Yeah. And so Broderbund had representatives that would go over to Japan every now and then and try to scout out, you know, what's going to be the hot new game and, hey, let's license it for North America. And I guess they liked Deadly Towers. That game is rough, but Alan Weiss, who I interviewed, said that game is not as bad as people think. He's like convinced it was way better than some of the other games. But
by complete coincidence, I talked to Alan Weiss last week, and he also talked about how Deadly Tower is a pretty good game.
Wow. Was it like fresh off of this conversation, or is he just thinking about how good Deadly Tower is all the time?
Well, I was talking about NES stuff in general.
Like, sure.
I think he was essentially what you'd call a producer on all of the NES titles.
Right. He was kind of the guy in charge of like picking the games that they would publish on the Nintendo Entertainment System. So he's very, I can imagine why he would be defensive of Deadly Towers.
So how does Broderbund and the U-Force meet? What is the meeting of these two things?
It was basically very simple. Dave Capper knew Ed Bernstein, and Ed Bernstein was the vice president of New Ventures, which was a subdivision in Broderbund, and they were kind of in charge of the Nintendo games, which, by the way, New Ventures, Alan mentioned to me that division started only because they wanted to make that board game, Personal Preference. It was the only reason they created New Ventures.
Well, which was by
it was a Carlston brother.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So, you know,
they started a division to publish their brother's board game.
Yeah, because
it's kind of cute.
They needed retail space, right, to sell this game. And so if you're a computer software company, you can't really get an in with like the toy industry to make a board game. So they made New Ventures, which was like the toy division of Broderbund, and made Personal Preference. But New Ventures was in charge of basically anything that wasn't computer software. So that included Nintendo Entertainment System. And so Dave Capper knew Ed Bernstein, who was the vice president of New Ventures. And he just said, hey, we've got this controller. We've got it interfaced with the Nintendo Entertainment System. We want you to come check it out. And so Ed Bernstein and Alan Weiss and a few other people from New Ventures drove out to, I'm going to assume, was Stan Axelrod's house and tested this controller with Rad Racer, which is a great game for Stan mm-hmm. Axelrod to play. Right? Yeah. So they played Rad Racer and they said, you know what, this is kind of cool. I think we should try this. This will make a big splash in the video game industry.
And it does. I mean, they bring it to the winter CES show of 89, right? And mm-hmm. it seems like it has so much coverage compared to all of the other controllers that are debuting at that show.
I think it was the most shocking discovery of my research was how much people talked about the U-Force. You know, I search Power Glove, U-Force, all these other controllers, and U-Force just kept coming up over and over and over and over. I mean, people. Well, you know what
doesn't even come up in your video is that it was the cover of Video Games and Computer Entertainment. Like, yeah. Literally, the cover of an issue of that magazine is the U-Force.
Yeah. Yeah. People were really, really excited about it. They thought about the possibilities of this controller. And one of my favorite things I read about from newspapers was, like, people were talking about, oh, could I use this at home? Could I use it with my computer? Could it replace a computer mouse? And then Bruderbund claimed the automobile industry wanted to try the U-Force out in cars. I don't know how that, I guess to like change your air conditioning settings or something. I don't know for sure, but
to drive the same way you do in Rad Racer.
Yeah, imagine
your hands pantomiming a steering wheel instead of actually touching a steering wheel.
Yeah, imagine driving a car with your U-Force.
It sounds wild. So dangerous.
I'm thinking shift gears. I don't know.
Yeah.
All of it sounds stupid. Fourth gear. All of it sounds really stupid. But yeah, I mean, this is not shocking in retrospect to me anyway, because this was radical new technology. It really, you know, if you're someone in 1989, we're using like touch tone phones and stuff, you know, to see tech where it's like, you magically wave your hand and something happens on the screen.
Extremely Star Trek. Like,
yeah. Yes.
This kind of technology looks like it is just eons in the future at this time period. So, yeah, I mean, I agree. I don't think it's surprising in retrospect, but I think most people, their experience with the U-Force is first colored by the fact that they've used one or maybe watched like an angry video game nerd video right. about it or something.
Right.
And they're like, well, it's bad. So, but the technology is really cool.
It is. And I think what shocked me about it was, I guess it speaks to how good Mattel marketed the Power Glove, because I think everyone is familiar with the Power Glove and they think back to that era and they're like, oh, virtual reality on video games. Oh yeah. Power Glove. I remember the Power Glove, but U-Force was really the talk of the town. I mean, when you go back and look at these articles and coverage of the CES shows, it was all U-Force. And it makes sense because yeah, you're not touching anything, but you're playing a game. Whereas the Power Glove, you still have to put a glove on and it's connected to your Nintendo, you know? So you have this giant,
you have to set up all these sensors around your TV.
Yeah, it was a pain. And you know, just from experience, yeah, I think I've played the U-Force more than anyone in the past 10 years. But the U-Force works, I think, way better than the Power Glove. But we'll get to that later.
It's not saying a ton, but
yeah.
Well, okay, so we're coming out of this CES show, 100 million in orders. There are $100 million worth of retailer orders coming in who are very excited for this thing. But I mean, you're talking about the Power Glove already. I mean, they're very worried about this looming threat of Mattel. I mean, it's the Power Glove. It's not great or whatever, but it's Mattel. That's the scary part.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. And you know, it's Mattel versus Bruderbund. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned in the video, Bruderbund didn't make hardware. Their only experience was a computer program called Science Toolkit, and it had this little module you could hook up to your computer. And, that's literally the only piece of hardware they ever made. And so they had to make the U-Force now, and they had really no experience with manufacturing. Whereas Mattel, I mean, they're making toys all the time. They have manufacturing pipelines already in Asia to make this stuff. So it was a learning experience, I guess, for Bruderbund. And I don't think they realized what they were getting into when they decided to take on this project.
Well, it's not just the marketing part, right? It's also just not knowing manufacturing woes quite as well. I mean, I imagine Capper must have had some experience with that, but for Bruderbund, it was probably brand new to just during production just keep finding all these flaws that need to get fixed. I mean, the one that comes to mind for me in the video, well, there's a ton of them, but you know, the biggest one being like the hinges on the thing, because you're supposed to be able to lay it flat or prop it open 45 degrees like a laptop, and those hinges failed all the time, even in the shipped units.
Yeah. And to Bruderbund's credit, they did hire some consulting groups to like help them make this thing, because again, they didn't really know how to do this. But yeah, it's funny. When I talked to John Mann about this, he was like, you know, today it seems so basic. It's like any laptop, you open it up and the screen holds at whatever position you want. But he's like, back then it was kind of a new thing. We had to figure out how the hinge is going to work. And yeah, it has to be able to lay flat, it has to be able to come up to a 110 degree angle and stay there. And then it has to come up to a 90 degree angle and stay there. And so they had this hinge with, you know, depending on the plastic they use, sometimes it would crack because it has to hold in that position. And there's like a lot of weight on that hinge. So that, I think Capper said that was the biggest hurdle was that hinge. It was a pain in the butt to figure out.
You mentioned some other problems as well, mostly with the IR sensors, right? So they were having a hard time, you know, calibrating them consistently. They were having a hard time even finding plastic that allowed IR light to come through.
Yeah. So that was one of my favorite stories. They were testing these prototypes they made in the factories, and it was so inconsistent. Some would work, some would barely work, some wouldn't work at all. And so an engineer was like, what is going on? And he grabbed the plastic and he was able to just like bend it completely. And he was like, okay, the plastic I ordered should just snap. It shouldn't bend like this. And so they realized, oh, this is plastic that infrared cannot penetrate. It'll just block infrared signals. So they, it was like, and I kind of felt bad for them because it's like, it's a huge time sink and it's a huge money sink. Every little issue you run into, it's going to delay your manufacturing and it's going to cost money. And so the plastic was one thing. And then the infrared emitters and detectors, like some were more powerful than others. And so they had to like come up with this jig that could pair them together so each U-force would work consistently. And it just seemed like a manufacturing nightmare. I think that was one of the biggest problems with the U-force.
And all of this ends up causing a delay. Like they have to not hit their July target and shoot for instead the holiday 89 season. Is that?
Yeah. In the winter show, they said, yeah, we'll have it out by July. And even when I read that, I thought, man, that is fast. Like that's really fast. And yeah, of course they don't hit that. And they say, okay, well, we're going to get it out by the holiday season. And as we'll see later, they weren't really able to hit that either. They kind of were, but yeah.
Yeah. So they end up, you know, essentially solving maybe not as well as the initial prototype, but they solve the manufacturing issues. I believe the video says they have the cost down to 22, which was up from 20, but still like
not bad.
Still good margins here on what, like $40-$60 products, something like that. Mm-hmm. They go test it, right? They do a test market, kind of a common thing with retail products. And they go for Sacramento because they're in the Bay Area, but they want something a little more not San Francisco. Right?
So. Yeah, and it's funny, that is apparently that's a very common city to use as a test market.
Interesting.
It's a very good representation of the United States, I guess. Whereas San Francisco, yeah, I guess it would not be.
Yeah. I mean, it does feel like a very different place when I drive the 2 hours there or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's just like, oh, there is suburbia. Like that exists around here. That's a real thing.
So I want to back up just a minute because they show the U-Force again at another CES before this even gets to Sacramento, is that right?
Right. So they show it again at the summer CES show.
Yeah. And it struck me as kind of odd that at the second time they're showing it, and just months before it's about to come out, they're still not letting anybody play it. They just have like a kid who is demonstrating it.
Yep.
I didn't see you mention any of this, but like no journalists were like, this is fishy. Like, why can't we play it? This probably doesn't work.
No, yeah, they were just mesmerized by it, and they said, you know, and there was accusations that, oh, there's somebody like hiding behind a curtain playing the game, and this kid's just like pantomiming this stuff or whatever, but what he was playing with was like what, like we were talking about earlier, one of those like well-built prototypes with like really good infrared emitter detectors. So, I mean, he was really playing it, but yeah, they wouldn't let the public play it.
That's so weird to me. I would.
Now they did let some like journalists play it, because even in those like news stories that I was showing, some of the reporters were able to like mess with it a little bit, but
oh, okay.
Yeah. But like any, like if I walked up, they wouldn't let me play with it or anything, you know,
you'll break it.
Yeah.
You'll break the force field.
And another thing I found interesting, I read an article where somebody asked Dave Capper, does this thing use infrared? And he said, no, it doesn't. And I think he was just trying to protect his patent, because the patent was pending at the time, and he just didn't want to say how it worked.
Interesting.
I thought that was interesting.
Did you confront him with that? Like, why did you lie?
Why are you a liar, Dave Capri? No, I didn't ask him about that.
No, that's, yeah, I could see that. That's pretty funny, though. It's magic instead. It's not
infrared. It's all magic.
It's just magic.
Yeah.
That's new proprietary Bruderbun technology.
Yeah.
Not IR. So, I mean, the test market is sort of 6 months after this second showing, holiday-ish Sacramento. Apparently it goes pretty well, right? It goes well enough that they're like, okay, we've got something here. Let's do a national rollout. But really it ends up like two problems, right? First, they couldn't really get the manufacturing going, it seems like, as well as they wanted to, because they only ended up shipping like a quarter of the units that they had pre-sold. I mean, it's, well, that's something I'm not clear on. Let's turn that into a question.
Yeah.
Right. So like they had 100 million in sales, right, meaning, you know, stores, Walmart, Toys R Us, et cetera, placed $100 million in orders that January when it was crazy. They only end up shipping, I think you said 27 million
right
in order. So about a quarter of that. Right. Why is that? Were they canceled orders? Were they unable to keep up with manufacturing?
It was, I actually asked this question because it confused me as well. I was like, what exactly happened? And he said it was kind of a combination of all those things. It was retailers canceling pre-orders. It was Bruderbund canceling manufacturing because they saw the sales numbers and said, this thing's not going anywhere. So it's kind of a combination of a bunch of factors as to how you go from 100 million to 27 million.
But I think, you know, ultimately the biggest factor of all that essentially everyone has identified is that there was no specific software support for this thing. So, you know, it looked cool watching what's his name, Josh, play Punch Out.
Josh.
Yeah. I want Josh's sweater.
Josh.
Okay, you're not the first person to mention this. They want Josh's sweater.
Yeah.
I tried to find Josh. I couldn't find him.
He's, I wonder if I went somewhere to school with him or something. I mean, we were in Vegas about the same age.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, what if you knew Josh?
I might have known Josh.
Go look through your old yearbooks. Yeah. See if anyone's wearing a U-Force sweater. Yeah.
Has kind of like a mullet with a U-Force sweater.
We all had mullets in
there. Yeah, you're right.
It looked cool playing Punch Out or whatever, but it's like no pre-existing software actually demonstrated the U-Force, right? The U-Force allowed, for example, for analog control, right? It's you could, instead of just pressing up and it says go up, you know, you could control the speed of going up by sort of moving your hand, for example. And even at these shows, they didn't have any example software, which kind of blows my mind that they didn't even just have, you know, janky software that let people play. I mean, like the theremin example, right? Like just have a throwaway theremin, or just even have the equivalent of the LED lights on the prototype box that Kelsey mentioned, right? Like let people sort of understand the potential. It's like that. It seems like they didn't even have that for demonstrations. At least in the timeline in your video, it seems like they didn't even attempt to commission software for this themselves until it was done.
Yeah, and that was something that Dave Capper mentioned and something Alan Weiss mentioned too, is like, by the time they just commissioned a company to make a game for this thing, it was kind of too late at that point. But yeah, I think they had high hopes that companies would see this U-Force and say, oh man, this is really cool. We're going to make a game for this thing. And in the video I mentioned, Alan Weiss told me this story that he took a U-Force to Nintendo of Japan and he sat down with Miyamoto and some of the engineers and said, look at this device we came up with. And he said, Miyamoto just kind of like had a nice smile. And he's like, oh, it's very interesting. Thank you for showing me this. But it was clear that like, he had no interest in making anything for this thing.
This is actually the most surprising thing for me and why I am very convinced that, like, this is Miyamoto. He is a man who can see potential in strange ways of interacting with video games, like, more so, at least, you know, over the years, than any other game developer I can name. If anyone's going to be excited about an emerging technology like this, it should be Miyamoto. He should have had like 100 ideas for this thing. And that's why it's very clear to me that, yeah, they needed some way of... that must not have just been like communicated well to him, like the potential of this thing or what was really happening under the hood. And if, to Frank's point, if they had even just had the equivalent of that LED prototype just to be like, look, all kinds of things can happen when you move your hands around rather than, you know, move your hand this way, it's punch right, move your hand this way, it's punch left. Like,
yeah,
I think there could have been like, this could have had a lot of potential if people had been able to see that this was an interesting way of interacting with games.
Yeah, it was the biggest problem with the U-Force is it had this really unique way of playing games and it had analog control, which any pre-existing Nintendo game, it's not going to have because there was no controller that could really do that. And so they eventually did commission a game that had analog controls. But like I mentioned, it was way too late at that point. I mean, the U-Force was basically dead in the water by the time they were even thinking of publishing a game for it.
Well, let's talk about that game. So, Norm, you and I are one of a small but elite crew of people who have actually played U-Force Power Games.
Yes, the U-Force Illuminati. <That's
right>. So, you know, this was essentially... So, U-Force Power Games, it was planned as a commercial product. In practice, it's 4 tech demos to demonstrate the U-Force.
Yep.
You know, for those who haven't played it, which is literally everyone listening.
That's okay. Someone made a run of Retro USB made a multi-cart run of this.
Yeah,
they did. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, the ROM's out there.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Not the only people in the world who played it.
I think Alan Weiss was the one who released the ROM.
He's the one who sold
it. Yeah, he sold it on eBay. He sold it. Let me correct it.
But yes, it I'm pretty sure it originated from Alan. Yeah.
Yep.
Anyway. So essentially it's a compilation of 4 mini games. I think the one that shows the potential most, and you highlight this pretty early in your video. I don't know the name of the mini game, the title they gave it or whatever, but it's the firefighting one.
Ah, yes. Hose them down.
Where you control the power of the fire spray to rescue people from windows. And I'm having a weird realization right now. I'm having this live right now. So I at Other Ocean, the game developer I used to work at, we were commissioned by Microsoft to make a demonstration game for a Windows phone that didn't come out that was able to read your hand position in space in front of it, including, you know, distance of finger and angle and stuff like that.
Did you rip off Hose 'em Down?
I think I did. So my
accident.
My game proposal was, you're looking at a building and it's a grid of windows with fires and it, I called it Finger Hose, and it was just like you, like you, you, well, because the idea, it's a project name, it doesn't have to be final, and the idea was like your finger was the hose putting out fire, yeah. And you could like twist to go from, you know, straight nozzle to like spread, which was weaker, you know, you could angle and stuff like that. And I think I was ripping off Hose 'Em Down, like very subconsciously.
I think
it's just the obvious idea. I don't know.
You're lucky Pose didn't catch wind of this finger hose project.
Tose, who we were working with at that same time. Yeah, wait a minute.
It's all, everything's connected, isn't it?
Not on that project or anything. But yeah, Hose 'Em Down was you controlled the position and the power of your water stream just using your hand, right? So moving it left and right and then up and down. And water would essentially rescue people out of the burning building, which doesn't make any sense, but that's fine. But it was a really good demonstration, and you illustrate this beautifully in the video, because you have a side by side of the U-Force with the gameplay, and you're able to show like how the water stream moves essentially in real time with your hand.
Yeah, and I do a little behind the scenes tidbit. That was the most frustrating experience of all time of recording footage, because it was U-Force Power Games is a prototype. The game would crash constantly. Mm-hmm. And of course, you're playing with a U-Force, so you've just got a lot going against you when you're recording.
Demonstrated it beautifully. So thank you. I appreciate your sacrifice.
It was the best take I could get.
I think there were two builds of the game dumped. Maybe you played the earlier one.
It's very possible. It crashed a lot.
I don't remember it crashing. I think you played the wrong one. Yeah. Sorry.
Now, when it did work, it worked great. But yeah, it crashed a lot for me.
So between that and the mini game where you like make music, if someone had shown that to Miyamoto,
the theremin, like,
it's Wii Music.
He would have been Miyamoto, on board.
It's Wii Music in 1990.
I know.
Come on, man.
Well, I completely understand Miyamoto not seeing any business potential here.
Sure.
Like it's your,
because it's an expensive peripheral.
That someone else makes.
Yes.
That's the important part. So I can see that. I am having a hard time, however, imagining Miyamoto not showing any joy.
Yeah, like the word lukewarm. I'm like, you showed it to Miyamoto and he was lukewarm about this? It's fascinating.
It's funny, when I was doing research, I wanted to try to figure out if there were any other like developers that had any interest in the U-Force. And I found in the back of it was a game that Jalico put out, Astyanax. Is that how you say it?
That is how you say it.
I learned that in an earlier episode that I forget which one.
Oh.
But excellent. We've had a lot of pronunciation discoveries on this podcast.
Oh, yeah. So in the back of that manual, they had a little survey, and they're like, what Nintendo controllers do you enjoy using with your system? And U-Force was an option. So I wonder if Jalico is trying to get a sense of like, is anyone playing with a U-Force out there?
Yeah, that's easy market research, right?
Yeah.
How many survey answers of U-Force would it have taken them to start considering
only
100.
Yeah, I have no idea. Probably a lot, but I think I had a quote from an analyst. It was a really good quote, and he just said, you know, if you're a kid and you've got and you've got like $70 to spend, are you going to buy a controller? Or are you going to buy two games? And it's like an easy answer, I think, for a kid. They're going to buy two games.
Yeah, maybe if the controller came with a cool game, right?
And that's what Dave Capper, in retrospect, he's like, I wish we would have just made it work really well with one game, and it came packaged with it, and it would have done a lot better. And I think he's probably right. But you know, it's easy to say that in retrospect, right?
Yeah, and I mean, having used the thing. Oh, well, I mean, really quick, the rest of the game. So there's the fire hose game that's probably that shows the potential the most.
Yeah.
There's Nuclear Rat Attack. I do know the name of that one, and that's essentially, well, I think you even describe it this way. It's whack-a-mole.
It's whack-a-mole.
So there's nuclear rats, and they're coming out of four tubes, And yeah, I don't know if you punch him. Or, I don't know what the canon is, the story for the game, but you touch the quadrant where the rat is, and then they're not a rat anymore.
Turns out it's a Metroid game. it's canon. It's in the Metroid.
It is the only third party canon Metroid.
Yeah.
There is essentially a theremin. It's like it's a demo theremin, yeah. of a theremin. You pick an instrument and you move your hand up and down to do a, you know, theremin light, let's say. Mm-hmm. And the final game is a basketball game where you have to do a pretty elaborate series of moves to jump and then throw the ball.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Yeah.
Can't believe you figured that out. I couldn't.
Okay. Do you want to know how I figured it out?
Yes.
Did you watch
the CES footage of
the girl playing. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. I was watching the footage of the person demoing it, and I was just like, wow, I cannot tell what these moves correspond. Like, they don't make logical sense.
No.
So,
because of course, this thing has no manual. It doesn't tell you. No. It only tells you where to set the dip switches on screen. It shows you how to set the dip switches, but it doesn't tell you what anything does. So I was trying everything. I didn't know what position the U-Force should be in. I didn't know what buttons did what. And so I found that CES footage and I was like, oh my God, she's playing Power Field B-ball. And yeah, it's like to jump, you got to move to the right. And then to shoot it, you have to go to the left and go up. The only thing that's natural of that is one of the buttons to dribble, you just do that.
You dribble and over.
It works
the,
great. Okay. Yeah, you can dribble. Cool. But everything else is wild.
Yeah, we, so back when I worked at 1UP forever ago, I did a stream with Scott Sharkey, and I was like, we're going to be the first people to ever actually play this thing on video, and we were. we figured out the rest, but just that basketball game was just probably like 20 very uninteresting minutes of us flailing around trying to figure out how to jump and shoot a basketball. Mm-hmm. It's like you figure out the jump and you're like, okay, I can make them jump, but then they just like hold on to the ball and land. So it's like, how do I release them? And like sometimes it would just happen and be like, how did I do that?
Yeah. And while you're dribbling, if you stop this motion, the guy just like stops and the ball falls and you turn it over. And it was a two-player game, so like one of you would use the left side of the U-Force and the other would use the right side. So like
If we knew that, we could have actually played a competitive game.
Now you know. Now you can get the band back together. Let's do it.
All right, Sharky, get back here. That cartridge, it just doesn't feel like a commercial game to me even. It, like, that's the tech demo that should have been at CES. That's really all it feels like to me.
It does feel like a tech demo. And Alan Weiss mentioned that. He said it just wasn't very fun. It was just like, here's what the U-Force can do, but it's not like it was enjoyable to play, you know?
Yeah, it's not like there was a compelling game and then three mini games. It's just like for whatever mini game. Yeah,
I mean, how long are you going to sit there and play Rock on Air? You're like,
it's not
a few seconds.
Yeah. Like, oh, I get it.
Yeah.
Like you can't compose music with it.
No.
You know, you can't, it's not like Electroplankton where anything sounds good. You know, it's just, you're just making noise.
Tosei did their best. It's still,
they did their best. And I think as a tech demo of the unit, it mostly succeeds.
Yeah.
So that game doesn't come out. It is shown at CES 90, I guess, winter CES 90, but it doesn't come out. Ultimately they just kind of give up and Brutobund even sells this division, the New Ventures division, to THQ, to Jack Friedman, who was running the place at the time, the founder. Did they ever actually do anything that you know of with the stuff they bought from Brutobund?
No, not that I know of. I thought like, I wasn't sure. I was like, did THQ like re-release any Brutobund games? And they didn't. According to Dave Capper, he said most of it was just sold to wholesalers and it was sold to KB Toys at like way discounted prices. And that's really all that happened with that inventory.
Yeah. So I just kind of wonder what they were I mean, Jack's been dead for a long time. Can't ask Jack, but it's like, what were they thinking? What did they even buy? Right. That's kind of what I'm wondering. Cause if you look through Bruderbund's console history, it's like, well, they licensed themselves or they licensed other games.
Right.
So what is it that you're purchasing? Is it the US distribution rights to some of these NES games? Mm-hmm. Do the remnants of THQ own U-Force Power Games
right now? I'm not sure.
Did that get spread out in the auctions, right? Does THQ Nordic own the U-Force brand, right?
If I get a copyright claim from THQ Nordic, we will have our answer, right?
Okay.
This is slander on our U-Force product.
So... weird, just sort of afterlife blip in the history thing, but I just found it fascinating. This thing just kind of shows up in the UK later.
Yeah, I love when stories like this come up, and I especially like it because I feel like a lot of my research is like North American centric, and so when I get to discover something that happened in Europe, it's always interesting. And yeah, so a guy who worked with Dave Capper on the Koosh line. I think he was working for Toys R Us in the UK, and he agreed to like buy a lot of this overstock of U-Force that Bruderbund had sitting around, I guess. And they released it in the UK in 1992.
Oh my god!
Two years after it died in North America, and still no game for it, by the way. And it was right. £50, which is still expensive. And I found this video game show called, you know, Game Master.
I knew it was Game Master. I recognized the weird blue screen.
Yeah, yep, and this kid was just like, it doesn't work. It's not good.
You didn't do the accent, but that's fine.
Not good at all. Not good. Yeah. And it was, what I loved about it was they put these stickers on the box of the U-Force that were like, it's for experienced players only. And it's not easy, and it's not meant to be easy. It's for the hardcore gamers who want to change the way they play their games.
I love that so much. I love that as like a way of getting around a bad product. Just like, instead of this doesn't work well, it's for experienced players only. And the fact that it's bad, that's a feature, not a bug. Like this is a selling point. It's not meant to be easy.
We designed it this way. And so, man, the reviews on that thing in the UK were hilarious.
Yeah.
Like I had
the total review.
I had to include that. Cause I was like, they just destroyed this thing. I felt bad for an inanimate object. Poor U-Force.
Instead of paraphrasing it, we're going to go ahead and encourage you all to go watch this video and see how Total reacted to the U-Force. It sounds really stupid to do that at first, but it's like, well, we don't know what their buyout, like that might've been like $2 a unit that they bought them for.
Yeah. Who knows? But it's just funny after the U-Force died, when Dave Capper was telling me the story of like how it got in the UK and how they sold all this inventory. And then Avi Arad's name comes up and I'm like, Marvel guy, what? And then he's like, yeah. And then he called Jack Friedman. I'm like, the LJN guy? Yeah. Everything's connected. I think we're onto something here. There's some sort of conspiracy or Illuminati. Everybody knows everybody, I guess, in the video game industry.
All collective consciousness thing to finally bring this motion sensing fireman game out.
That's right.
Like there's some kind of preordained fate that eventually this fire hose game with your hand is going to come out somewhere
for your Windows Phone.
For the Windows,
or something.
Phone.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The Windows Phone never shipped. I saw some leaked stories about it existing, so I don't think I'm breaking any NDAs, but it was never announced either. Also, who cares? Who cares? Who cares?
I hate for you to get in trouble for talking about the finger hose game.
Finger hose. It was really good, and they did a game that didn't work as well instead. That was Punch-Out, like. So
everyone's ripping off everybody is what you're saying.
Well, what I'm saying is that if you have motion sensing distance controls with your hand, you're going to revert to finger hose and punch out. every time.
Yep. And the Power Glove kind of did the same thing. It was like, and the Roland Rocker too. It was Rad Racer, yeah. Top Gun, Punch Out. Those three games, yep. Every VR controller was like, yeah, it works with these three games. Even the hot seat. They all worked with those three games. Nothing else.
Well, Norm, you were a delight. Thank you so much for coming back to the Video Game History Hour.
No problem.
Is this your last sort of obscure peripheral video a while?
I think so. I think I'm burnt out. I mean, I did. Here's the thing. It's fun to research these obscure things. I think this year has been weird. I feel like I've been stuck in the year 1989 all year.
Yeah.
Because I did the Homework First Lock, 1989. The Roland Rocker, 1989. The Mega Modem, 1989. U-Force, 1989.
Wow.
I'm stuck. So I'm stuck in 1989.
We're looking forward to
1990. Can you find Josh for us?
I'm still
on
the hunt.
Get one of those sweaters.
Yeah. Still on the hunt.
I think he's at CES. Go find him.
He's still there, just swatting at the air right now.
By the way, I do have a story about the U-Force that I didn't mention in the video because I couldn't verify it. But
okay.
Dave Capper told me an interesting story that I'd like to share. He said back in, I can't remember the year, 2009 maybe, he got a call from Microsoft asking about his patent on the U-Force.
Mm.
And then he tried to get back with them. They could never reconnect. And then a few months later, Xbox announces the Kinect, which uses infrared to track where you are in the camera.
I think you mean they announced Project Natal.
Sorry, my bad. Yes.
I was curious, and I had written this down even and just didn't bring it up, but he said, you know, in some of the footage that you used, he said Kinect used our technology.
Right. I was going to ask
so
that
I was
too.
Like,
and that's where it's from.
Is that true?
in a sense, I mean, it's using infrared to play a game, to control a game. So as far as that, yes. Did they actually look at his patent and say, we need to buy the right, but his patent expired. It expired and then the Kinect comes out. But I tried to verify this and like the dates didn't really match up. So I didn't want to say it in the video. So.
Well, at least you tried.
I tried.
So we will link to Norman's presence around the internet in the show notes. Of course we will link to this video. Please go give it a watch. But verbally, just in general, where can people find you on the internet?
The number one place to find me is youtube.com/gaminghistorian. And if you're a fan of the show and you want to support it and you want to see me make more 40-minute documentaries about a obscure piece of hardware, supporting
Konami.
1989, there's
no
a lot
you
more
move
to
on
cover.
To 90. Let's get to 90. Let's get to the links or something.
I do have a Konami laser scope sitting right here.
Oh, I love that thing.
It's 1990.
All right. Look forward to Gaming Historian covering the Atari laser scope coming soon.
Yeah. You can also find me on Twitter at Gaming Historian. And I was leading to this, but I am also on Patreon. Patreon.com/Gaming Historian. And actually, the U-Force episode is because of Patreon. They actually voted for me to look into it. So
whoa, okay,
that's the only reason the video was made.
Go join the Patreon if you're into stuff like this, because you obviously have a strange awesome community if this is what was voted for.
It you can force me to do a video on stuff like the U-Force.
You force.
Oh, I didn't even make the connection. Yes, you forced me. By the way, second place in that poll was the Sega Activator.
Oh no! They're just going to make you do all of these terrible.
I know. Peripherals. Maybe it's a mistake.
The Activator has to also be IR.
Right? I have no idea. I've never messed with one. I just remember the ads with the guy with the long ponytail playing with it. That's it.
So Norman, thank you so much again for joining us. This is great.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to the Video Game History Hour, brought to you by the Video Game History Foundation. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Twitter at Game History Hour or email us at podcast@gamehistory.org. Did you know that the Video Game History Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit and that all of your contributions are tax deductible? You can support this podcast and all of our other work on Patreon or at gamehistory.org/donate. This episode of the Video Game History Hour was produced by Robin Kunimune and edited by Michael Carroll. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.